Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for coming to this celebration of John Bertram. My name is Chris. I'm John's son. This has been kind of an amazing week to realize just how many wonderful friends my dad has had. To be honest, it's been kind of hard to be sad with so many amazing people sending me emails and sending phone calls and all these messages of love. So personally, I just want to say a quick thank you for all of that. I felt like we needed some ceremonial kind of way to begin today's get-together. And as a percussionist, the thing that binds me to my friends is rhythm. So I thought we might try a kind of group rhythm thing. I don't quite know how to do this, so apologies if this is a little weird. But I wanted to do something that we could all be a part of. The thing that binds us all here is John. And we all knew him in this 71st year of his life. So my idea is that we're going to clap 71 times. As a percussionist, that's not a round number. It's a very difficult number to count. So what I'm thinking I'm going to do is I'm going to help us out by sort of keeping track of where we are within that. And we'll add into this clapping count as you enter John's life. So the few of you that knew John from day zero, you're going to be clapping the whole time. For those of you that met him this year, you're just going to clap one time at the very end. And we're going to work our way all up to 71. You think we can pull this off? Okay, so as I can sense, I think we need a moment to figure out when in John's life we enter. So what I'd like to do, and I think this is something that Dad would have done, in a moment I'm going to give you some time to turn to your neighbor, to introduce yourself, to ask my mom or your other friends questions, to figure out how old Dad was when you met him. So John was born in 1944, yeah, so how old am I now? 39. So, what year would that have been for me? I will converse with my mom. You do the same and figure out on that number from 0 to 71, approximately, when it is that you will join into the class. Does this make sense? So let me give you a couple minutes. You're welcome to stand and introduce yourselves to your neighbors. You're welcome to ask other people questions to figure this out. We'll be back in just a second. Okay. Does everyone have a guess at the number in John's life when they entered? Okay, this is Robert Bertram, John's older brother. And unless I'm mistaken, he might be the only person here that knew John from day zero. Does anybody else? Did anyone else know? Okay. Bob is going to be our rock. As he has been in so many ways. Bob is going to be clapping nice and slow. It's going to be like clap, two, three. Four, clap, two, three, four, clap. So this whole clapping series, we've got 71 of these, it's going to take a couple minutes. Yeah, this should be nice and peaceful. It doesn't need to be a super loud clap, it should just make a nice sound, and we'll gradually grow as we add in. As a guidepost, yeah, the kids, we enter at around 30. Yeah, mom entered around 20. Yeah. And I'll let you know, let's see, how am I going to let you know? I'll, on my hand.
Why don't you raise your hand every 10?
Exactly. Every 10, I'll let you know when we're at 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. Now here's the key. 60, 70, and then one last. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Any questions before we try this? No. Okay, so this will be the beginning of our ceremony today. Thank you very much for coming. After this, my mom will give a eulogy and we'll have some time for people to share experiences. The program is here. This is our rough guess at what we're going to do. So don't hesitate to let me know if I'm forgetting someone or something. Yeah, we're here to celebrate John, so we're all in this together. After the closing, there'll be food and we'll hang out for a bit. While I have your rapt attention, after this, there is a reception at my mom's place, so we'll be heading over there, and you're all invited to that as well. Bob?
I've had a realization that not only am I going to be clapping first, but I'm going to be clapping for a long time. And I think Diane is about going to be the first to join me, so maybe we'll do it a little faster for them.
No.
Okay, I'll stop.
Okay, ready? Here we go.
One, two, ready, go.
Thank you, Christopher. That was lovely. What a day this is. And I am so touched by your presence here. Thank you all so much for coming. It has been wonderful to have my children here with me. Christopher and Hiroka arrived on Sunday, and Nikki came on Monday, and Dan and our two granddaughters arrived yesterday. So that has been a wonderful thing, and I want to tell you how much it has meant to all of us to see the kindnesses that have been extended to us. So thank you so much for that. I'm honored to be here to celebrate John. I feel his wonderful openness, his gregariousness, his love of people, his love of you in particular, and his love of me. some of you know, it was remarkable. And so I feel this great responsibility today to honor him in a way befitting a husband like that. I think I fell in love with John when we were sitting in his 1956 green Chevy, which he affectionately called Old Green, behind University of Wyoming's Fraternity Row. And I was telling him about Canterbury Tales, and he was really listening. I remember feeling a little surprised by his rapt attention. But heavens, I thought, I love this guy. After our marriage, 48 years and 6 months ago, we drove to our first home on the naval base at China Lake with everything we owned in the back of a Jaguar XKE. John, in his gregarious extroversion, and me as rather the opposite of that. And so we began our life together. As I look back on those 48 years, two of John's qualities that I find most precious are his acceptance of people and the affirmative way he lived his life. In exploring those, I want to tell you a little bit about him as a father and as a Van Gogh aficionado. When Christopher was a child, around 8 years old, I suppose, I became aware that his sweet, gentle, sensitive nature wasn't becoming less a part of him in his growing up, but that it was becoming more a part of him. And I knew that I needed to protect that from a culture that does not value those qualities as male characteristics. And most importantly, I thought I might need to protect him from John, who after all might be like so many other fathers I had seen who seemed threatened or frightened by those characteristics in their sons. And in ways subtle and overt, tried to change them into something more acceptable. So I watched carefully, ready to protect Christopher if I needed to. But there was no need. John loved Christopher just as he was. And in my seeing that, I remember feeling that I had learned something so wonderful about the kind of man I had married. So for those of you who know Christopher and have seen his kind of incredible sweetness, John's acceptance is in that, too. John was the parent who usually said yes, and I was the one who was inclined to say no, often around monetary issues. Isn't that too expensive? I would say. So when Nikki wanted to go to Stanford, I said things like, but you can go to our alma mater, the University of Wyoming, for in-state tuition. But John prevailed, and Nikki went and thrived in that environment of unlimited opportunity. She says yes to life, like John. Yes, I can do that. I can move to a developing country with my two little girls and husband, and then I can leave it for the 7,800 elevation of Colorado. Yes, 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 just like John. And Hiroka, who has been to John like a daughter, especially since she stayed with us for 6 weeks last spring. She had lost 25% of her body weight and was in intense pain. Maybe because John was so familiar with pain and diminishment from his 7 years of dealing with the complications associated with cancer, she and John formed a bond around their common adversaries. Whatever he could do, he did for Haruka, like any good father would. He surrounded her with his affirmative way of being in the world, telling her, we are going to get better, we are going to get better, and we're going to fatten you up. And today, having gained 19 pounds and feeling well, she will tell you that John helped save her life. He was a father to her too. And John's love of Van Gogh, his heartfelt response to his art, John's dedication in trying to approach what he called Van Gogh's genius in his own reproductions, his attention, his patience, were amazing to me. I have watched him work with the tiniest of brushes, carefully dipping just the tip of the brush, just so, in the paint, and applying it precisely just so. That process again and again, the painting developing slowly over so many hours, is tribute to the genius he saw in Van Gogh. Last Sunday, when we returned from the emergency room and John's dear best friend, Porter Underwood, lifted John from the wheelchair to what would be his bed, we chose the couch in our TV room because there John would be able to watch the Golf Channel. But also in the TV room are most of John's Van Gogh paintings. John never revived enough to watch golf. But 2 days later, John died in the presence of the painted Vincent. Vincent Van Gogh was probably the only person whom John had never actually met, whom he loved. Not only his art, but his spirit. John was so saddened by the fact that Van Gogh had so few people in his life who valued him. Perhaps some of you came to his Van Gogh and Friends presentation in which he talked about the 7 people who were good to Van Gogh and the sort of quiet tragedy that Van Gogh spent so much of his life misunderstood, alienated, and alone. John so appreciated Theo, who supported him, who sent him money and painting supplies and tried to sell his paintings. And Johanna, Theo's wife, who recognized the artistry in Van Gogh's paintings and saved them and all of his letters. He was so touched by her. In fact, if you came to John's Van Gogh and Friends presentation, you know that he was so moved by her letter about Vincent, that he was unable to read it. And so I would read it for him. He often told me that he would so have liked to have been in Van Gogh's life, to have been kind to him in spite of his strange and erratic behavior, in spite of his difference. And so John took that as his responsibility. The way that he wanted Van Gogh to be treated was the way that John treated everyone. He thought that was really everyone's responsibility to each other. People looking at John's paintings, of Van Gogh's paintings, would sometimes rather jokingly remark, that they thought that John was channeling Van Gogh. But perhaps the person that John really channeled was Johanna, who loved Vincent in spite of the difficulties of doing so. Her acceptance of Vincent, her admiration of his art, her affirmation of what he was, her appreciation of him. No wonder John held her in such high regard. He was that kind of person also. And I am happy to tell you that John died in her painted presence too. He died with Johanna there, representing John's acceptance of people. Me, who perhaps loved him the most, his beloved daughter, Nikki, who shares his affirmative way of being in the world, Christopher, who cried unashamedly, and with Hiroka, his newest daughter.
Thank you.
John was not a particularly religious person, but he and Diane found a little slice of heaven here in Bear Valley. It's such a wonderful place with such wonderful people. It is just a wonderful thing to be here. I have to tell you that, to tell you the truth, I found myself angry about John dying. That emotion doesn't mean anything because it's something we all must live with, and I have told myself all those things I tell other people, and none of it works. But this gathering today makes me feel much better. I talked to Brother John about 10 minutes every working morning, which was about as long as he liked to talk, being an efficient person, and therefore I'll try to keep my talk to about 10 minutes. I want to tell you a little bit about our youth, which my children call the Flintstone era. John, when he was in ninth grade, carved a car out of balsa wood, and he painted it, and he won the General Motors Craftsman's Guild Award for Wyoming. The next year, he carved a car again, and this time he won the Western Region. Bollywood. I might tell you, I think I've seen his design in cars for decades. General Motors did a bright thing by having that Craftsman's Guild. In high school, he got a 1935 Chevrolet with just the body, the running gear, steering wheel. He put in a Chrysler engine, Mercedes seats, instrumentation, and electrical wiring, and painted that car a bright red. I was certain that he became a mechanical engineer. I was sure he was going to be an automotive engineer. He was so energetic. I know, we wrestled every day. He worked at a pizza joint, an auto body place, a paint shop, and a mortuary. We played sports. We were in scouts. Dad took us fishing. John played the violin. He played the trumpet. He had a dance band. He was a good dancer. He was popular. I have to tell you that I'm afraid that one time his advice to me was not as successful. I came back from college. He was still in high school, and I was going to go to a high school dance, and I asked him, well, what shall I say to a high school girl? I think he was a little dismissive or wasn't listening. He says, oh, just anything. Just compliment the decorations. So I asked a girl to dance, and I said, what great decorations. And she said, oh, those old things, they've been there for 6 months. But his advice was usually good. In his freshman year, he was a reasonably good student in high school, not a straight-A student. In his freshman year of college, he joined a fraternity, and he had a lot of fun, and he almost flunked out. He came to me after the semester and he said, Bob, if you have fun and the grades aren't there, it isn't worth it. You've never seen a greater change in a human being. He became the most serious student in history. He took those courses over again. He was the best mechanical engineering student. He was chosen as most likely to succeed, president of his fraternity. I noticed Diane telling us how she met John. Well, not long after that, John brought her over for dinner one night. I could tell he was a goner right then. And she tells me about his rapt attention to Canterbury Tales. I'm sure it's begun to dawn on her that his attention was not entirely due to his interest in Canterbury Tales. He was not only chosen most likely to succeed in this engineering society, other students told me they, when they couldn't solve problems, they asked him. He was offered jobs by 22 corporations before he joined Shell. When he went to Navy OCS and became an officer, he went to Da Nang, and he had 100 CBs, 100 Koreans, and 100 Vietnamese. He was in charge of what I think is 50 square miles of Da Nang Air Base, a Navy captain's job, though he was a JG. When he came back from the Navy, he was presented the Bronze Star on Armed Forces Day by the commander of the Pacific Fleet. So you can see that he did a good job, but I'm afraid that he was hurt emotionally very badly by having an office next to one of the two morgues in Vietnam, Cameron Bay and Da Nang, and he watched the coffins go by. So he ended up questioning a lot of the decisions about the employment of military power. Our father at 35 was military governor of Nuremberg and commander of the troops after the war, having landed in Utah Beach. So we were from a military family, and I drew combat pay in Korea. I appreciate the military, but we've had a lot of discussions about that. You know by now about the many things he has done as a man. I can't really begin to tell you all of them, some in the program. I do want to, we have a younger brother, he's only 66, a mere stripling. He wrote something, I want to read it. He said, John had an infectious enthusiasm and optimism, but at the same time was deeply aware of the troubled times in which we live and saddened by the suffering of so many. He was a true idealistic, and that had a lasting effect upon me. He had a gift of working well with people, which would later become a benchmark of his life, training people to work together and that many hands make light work. When I visited his office upon the occasion of his retirement, the expressions of appreciation and affirmation by his co-workers regarding his positive influence in the working environment was deeply touching. I remember the CEO telling me that day he had decided to stop his work managing oil fields and things like that and work on teaching people to work better in groups. And the CEO told me that the company now worked on his model. Tom was introduced by John to a couple who took his training course over a couple of years. And Tom writes that they were effusive with the inspiration they found in his training and the passion with which they shared his knowledge. The fact that this couple runs a major enterprise with over 8,000 employees certainly added to the meaningfulness of their appreciation. I'm so appreciative of all of you being here today. I'm sure you remember John as I do. Thank you.
Now is the time when we'd like to open up the mic to others to share some of their experiences with John.
I felt quick to stand up because I've known John shortly after they moved to Bakersfield, which is in the late 80s, I think. So somewhere between 27 and 30 years ago. And they quickly became my best friends. And later in life became one of my strongest supporters. Especially when I moved up here. I changed life and moved up here. And I ate more meals with John Diane than I ate myself. Diane's a great cook. You all know John's ability with reproducing Van Gogh and his painting. I didn't appreciate his artwork that much. I thought he was painting by the numbers type of thing. Well, then I finally found a repressed desire to do some artwork from a second grade experience. And to do that, I had to take art lessons. So Deanie is here in the audience. She was our instructor, and John and Alfred Gray and I were taking lessons from her. And now I have a tremendous appreciation for how hard it is to even paint an apple, let alone Van Gogh. John had many other talents. Some have been mentioned all here. He was an expert Sudoku player. And where I feel wonderful finishing off an easy or medium puzzle, he would go to, his was ninja. The cutthroat, the harder the better. And he'd usually have it done before he finished his coffee in the morning. And then he had a tremendous ability to sleep instantaneously. He could put his head on his chest and sitting up, and in two breaths, he's snoring. And that worked for him in many ways, and sometimes it worked against him because he also liked to be asleep at 9 o'clock. So if we were at a party together, many times Diane had to elbow him to keep him keep his chin off his chest. And then he was a motorcycle rider. We both bought our Gold Wings in 2002. And what I regret is that we didn't take enough tours together after a year or so. I had another year at work before I retired so we could go full-time riding. And he gave up the ghost following year and sold it to a good friend of mine who we went on many tours together. But then as Bob just mentioned his teaching, or Diane did, his teaching skills. And then his tennis playing, John Diane introduced me back into tennis, and I met a whole, that created a whole link of connections to people that I would have never met before, including our study group teachers that John and Diane were part of. And they also introduced me to line dancing, which set me in on a whole new course of activity and friends. But the big thing, John loved golf. And that's where I first met him, was on the first tee at Sundale Country Club years ago. And we became golf partners. Steve LeBellman back here. He's up from Bakersfield. He is one of those early golfers in our group. And he took lessons. He signed up for 6-week lessons. And when those 6 weeks were over, he signed up for another 6 weeks of lessons. Like everything he's been described about him, he wanted to be the best. He wanted to reach his potential. And he worked at it very diligently. And one of those schools, at Diane's encouragement, we went to Golf in the Kingdom in 1993 up at Esalen Institute at Big Sur. And right out of registration, we walked outside, and if anyone's been to Esalen, down on the cliffs of the ocean there are hot tubs, clothing optional. So I looked at John, I said, John, it looks like we're going to make a paradigm shift. And a couple hours later, we're down there in the middle of this wonderful place. And the funny part was, John continuously apologized for having white legs. I never got that. It's said that a true friend is someone who would give you a kidney if you needed one. John was that true friend. And I was that same true friend to him. If he needed a kidney, I would give him a kidney. If I could have done something to cure his cancer, I would have given it to him. And he died Tuesday afternoon. Wednesday afternoon, I went out and played a final round of golf with him. He's right there with me the whole way. We had 4 pars and 9 holes together. Walking down the last fairway, there's a beautiful blue sky with white puffy clouds, and we're almost to the green. I said, John, I'm going to miss you, buddy. But I'm carrying him right here, always. He's always with me. Thank you.
Still in his 20s. Baker, Montana. He was a foreman that I worked for. And he brought a sense to an oil field of rough and tough Montana oil field guys. And John had a sense of him that was, I'm sorry. what he brought was that gentle soul that we worked for a tyrant. I mean, that guy, you know, was not an easy person to work for. And John learned early on that sometimes his kind of gentler version wasn't necessarily appreciated by our boss. But he worked through that, and he helped us become better. While he was there, and you know, so he had that spirit his whole life. I had a couple things here that I was thinking about with beyond his smile was Vlad Porter said something about motorcycle, because he claimed he was a pretty good motorcycle racer, and Diana will remember this, that he wound up doing a motocross. There in Baker, although it didn't work out so well because one of our Rick games ran over him and broke his leg. So we weren't sure how good a motocross rider he really was, because I think he sold that bike as well. So he did give up that ghost. But when I first met John Diane, and my wife and I went out to dinner with him, and after dinner we're all leaving the event at the same time, and all of a sudden, my wife falls off and hits me. Did you see that? I said, see what? He opened the door for her. How come you're not doing that for me? I said, well, I think his door got jammed or something. I don't know what it was, but you know, John was definitely there for me early on in my career, and you know, I was very pleased to bump into John and Diane several times through our years, and you know, appreciate you coming to the law.
Hello, everyone. My name is Deepa Willingham. I met John when he was 62, and I was 65 years old. We were both Rotarians, and we were sent to India to do polio immunization. And we were sent to a town called Gajipur. I had two John gentlemen traveling with me. One was our John, and the other gentleman was from Conejo Valley. Well, the Rotarians there treated us like royalty, but they put us up at what they called a guest house, which was minus 3-star I had the job of making sure that my two John brothers were kept healthy, not putting anything in their mouth unless I okayed it. Well, you know John. The other John followed my instructions very well. But this John brother, he sees the best in everybody. He wanted to make the people who were making the food make them feel good. So in spite of my instructions, he would try to put things in his mouth like he was not supposed to. Finally, I had to take it. It's Indian custom is you call your elders Didi. So he saw all the other Rotarians were calling me Deepati. So he promptly picked that up. But I couldn't convince him that, John, you do not put food in your mouth unless I say so. Finally, we decided a facial expression. When something would come up, it was me doing this, and John would look very pathetic and try to avoid hurting the feelings of those who were preparing the food. This is who John was. And he started calling me Didi, and we became really like brothers and sisters over the years that I had known him. It is because of his desire to see peace come into the world, and because of his writings, that many of which I read over the years, that prompted me, he encouraged me to form the school that I formed, called Pace Universal. He saw the reason he supported it so much, and both Diane and him supported it, because they really were Renaissance people who understood what it would take to make the planet a safe planet. War wasn't the answer in John's mind. He had experienced it, and he wrote beautiful essays about it, and he always told me, Deepa, what you're doing is the way we will reach peace. So I'm going to miss my brother. I'm going to miss his ability to see the good in everybody. But I have to tell you, the universe has taken him someplace where his special kind of talent is needed to bring peace in throughout the universe. And he's on a journey to make other parts of the universe better.
Hi, everyone. I'm Colleen McCauley, and I first met John because he was one of my bosses as a board member of CASA of Kern County, and we raised up advocates for abused and neglected children. John served on the board for 6 years, and when John was getting off the board, I became the director. John continued to help the organization for 10 years. Even as he was going back and forth to chemo, and I was needing to have help He'd say, well, I've got to go over there, and then I'll come by and see you. I've got like 2 hours before he came up home. And John was, as other people have said, a safe place to land. And John and Diane were always so welcoming and opening to me. And John calmed me down when I was trying to do so much to help children. And a remembrance of him was he came to the offices, and I had just been the director a year, and had all these worries and worries and worries, wrote. And he was famous for those great big pieces of Post-it notes, 2 feet by 3 feet, that stuck on the wall. And he said, I just want you to write. What's bothering you? I'm going to write. And this is all confidential. All confidential. And we wrote like 7 or 8 pages full of all the things I was worried about, concerned about, didn't know about. And I'm like, oh. At the end, I felt so good. And I said, okay, John, what do I do next? And he said, well, I wouldn't begin to know what you do next. No kidding. I said, do you have a younger brother? The most wonderful man to pull it out of you and help guide you. The things that John has taught me over the last 14 years. In fact, I just came back from Arles in the south of France, and I was going to be so excited to tell him all the things I'd seen. I saw that picture. I saw the yellow house. I'll tell him that when I see him again. So the things that he taught me, I've taught others. And his legacy is he has helped CASA programs throughout the state of California and throughout the nation be better organizations. And I wanted to publicly state that he has helped system partners get away from the turf wars and to think globally about end solutions and how to let the egos go and to look in a more positive way of how we can find solutions. When I tell people you can accomplish 2 or 3 major things in a year as a well-developed organization, those are John's words to me. When you see people relax and say, oh, this is a process, it's not perfection. So his legacy to me and to really, thousands of people who are helping abused children throughout this nation is vibrant and real today and will go on for decades. When I meet with other directors, they say, I remember you said, and I said, those weren't my words, those were John Bergstrom's words. So what a gift to children throughout the nation. And with that, I'll give it up.
He was a great father, as you can imagine, and I remember as a child, he would tickle me and my brother so much that my mother would be sort of worried. And John, easy. Because I remember him tickling us so much that you just couldn't breathe. But it was always thrilling. And my father was always so fun, you know, like he thought of things that just never occurred to us, you know, like ping pong for Christmas. Of course, that was a thrill. Or I remember when he brought home a new television. It was, you know, my father just seemed to like come home with things that you, now looking back, I can see that he had planned that he had worked toward that for a long time. But as children, it was this wonderful gift. Like, oh, wow, I couldn't believe it. Of course, one of the things that my father and I shared was a love of cars. So when I think about sort of our progression together, I think of all the vehicles that we ever owned. The old Buick LeSabre wagon with the brown wood paneling. I loved it because the seats faced the back. Then we upgraded to the LeSabre sedan, the coupe, with the giant doors that I one day shut my hand in, or did, is that you? That Christopher shut his hand in. But you knew that my father, like, this was not satisfying to Dad. And he did, we ordered a Chrysler minivan, and that was still not what he was looking for. So that the day he came home with that little red Porsche, that's what he was really waiting for. And I know that it made him so happy to have that, you know, as Bob said, that piece of machinery that had such fine tuning. And he loved washing cars and tuning cars. And I will always, you know, you think about like what you will remember forever, and I will, the smell of glass cleaning products will always make me think of my father, because he needed a clean windshield no matter what. And so, in fact, the other day we were going through our car, and sure enough, Father had put in some glass cleaner and some paper towels, so that you could do that whenever you needed to, because you might need to do that. So there was, yes, the Porsche, the Nissan 300Z, there was some BMWs in there, then another Porsche, then there was the Toyota Prius, because I'm really going to try, and then he was like, life is too short, and he got rid of that, so I love that, and I don't know if I'm making this up, but I do feel like we used to pretend that we were in the market for cars and go to the Bakersfield Auto Mall and drive things around just for fun, which felt so legitimate with my father. So wonderful. So he really was a great father. When I, after college, decided I wanted to be a ski bum, he was totally supportive. I had a job that I didn't like. And I said, Dad, I don't like this. I want to quit. And he said, follow your bliss. And how liberating that was, that I could just quit that job and do what I really wanted to do. And my father always encouraged my brother and me to do whatever made us happy. And I think that's such a gift that he gave us, in addition to all the things that everyone else has mentioned about his generosity and his loving spirit. I mean, oh my gosh, as a teenager I used to roll my eyes because, of course, you took him anywhere and he was like, John Bergstrom. And he just like introduced himself to everyone. But of course, that's such a wonderful quality. In fact, we were looking at pictures, and there's a picture of my father in Japan, and he's standing in front of a map of the United States, and you can tell that he's like, I'm from Wyoming. And he's trying to explain to these Japanese people where Wyoming is and why it's so special. So he really is so dear. And I hope that I can be the kind of person that he was. When you talk about all of the wonderful things that he's achieved and the lives that he's influenced, you just hope that you can do as well.
So, thanks, Paul. Before we sing, I can't help but tell you that when John came back from India, he told me that when he went over, he was sitting next to a woman who had gone to school in India. I'm sure that's you, Dee Dee. And she said that her principal had been Mother Teresa. And so he, looking forward to this warm, fuzzy story, said, how did you like her? And she said, nobody likes their high school principal. And Porter, I also want to add that I didn't get to golf often with you and John, but one day we went out and played, and John hit three balls into the hole from off the green in one round, which is astonishing.
Make me a channel of your peace. Children, let me bring your love. Where there is injury, your pardon, Lord. And where there's doubt, true faith in you. Make me a channel of your peace. Where there's despair in life, let me bring hope. Where there is darkness, only light. And where there's sadness, only joy.
Oh, Master, grant that I may never seek so much to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love with all my soul.
Make me a channel of your peace. It is in pardoning that we are pardoned, in giving of ourselves that we receive, and in dying that we're born to eternal life.
Is there anybody else that would like to say? We have a few more minutes. If anyone else would like to speak, we'll have you come up and do that, and then we got one more song.
On several occasions, I had the honor of introducing John and his immensely popular talks about Vincent van Gogh. My job was an easy one because John, as gentle, soft-spoken, and self-effacing as he was a colorful figure. I like to point out that John was an oil man, but that he shattered the stereotype. He was a proud liberal, a passionate environmentalist, a lover of the arts, an artist himself. But most of all, he was a man obsessed. Ahab had his white whale. John had Vincent van Gogh. He dragged his lovely wife, Diane, all over the world to see his work and his workplaces. He practically memorized that definitive 900-page biography of the artist and probably knew more about him than anyone, with a single exception of Van Gogh himself. In fact, it was the artist who was the subject of the last conversation that I ever had with John just a few days before he passed. He told me that he had reconceived the book that he planned to write about his hero. He was going to call it not Van Gogh, but Van Goghs, plural. Why? Because, he said, nobody does it alone. He wanted to write not just about the artist, but about his brother Theo and Theo's widow, Johanna, the brother who loved him and was always there for him, the sister-in-law who dedicated her life to making him and his work famous. Well, it came as no surprise to me that John wanted to tell the story of the family. He loved the artist with a passion that passeth understanding, but he loved his family more. My favorites of all John's paintings are not his wonderful reimaginings of Van Gogh's works, but his portraits of his beloved Diane and Nemo. These portraits are love made visible. They are but two examples
of the fact that John was Theo to his family and to his friends. He was Theo. He was all of it, always there for all of us. And his departure leaves us with holes in our hearts. May flights of angels sing him to his rest.
Resources and eventually ERA that perhaps you know about. First, I would like to say that during that time, John was very outspoken about his love for his family. And yes, he talked about the cold days in Wyoming, and he talked about the Diane in his car, and he talked about the coldness in Baker, and then he talked about Nikki at Stanford. He talked about going to concerts with Chris. He talked about going to the Shakespearean Festival, the Jazz Fest. John very much loved his family. And so I think it would make John smile for me to quote Van Gogh, who said, "Love many things, for therein lies the strength. For he who loves much, performs much, accomplishes much, and if you do your work in love, then you do it well." John was a lover. And so I'm going to speak about two loves. The first is John loved learning. That was a big deal for us in ERA. John knew that trying to change an organizational culture was not easy. In fact, it was like, well, moving a mountain. And yet, it can be changed if you understand it. And John helped us with that. John understood that culture was like the air we breathe. It's all around us, but it's hard to see. And John helped us see the culture and our decisions and our processes, everything that made up ERA. He helped us challenge that with the questions he had. John understood that learning and changing organization culture was hard. It was not soft. John often said, "Bring a brave heart," because he understood that trying to change an organization culture could not be done very often and was often unsuccessful. And yet he helped us at ERA work through the behaviors and the processes and the decisions that made ERA what it is today. John was special in that regard. And the third thing John understood was that leaders need to be learners. And so as you hear the stories today, how he went to India and he worked with NASA and he worked with ERA and Shell, etc., you can see that he worked with leaders from the CEO down to the operator in the field. That's what made John special, because he could build trust. He could help us reflect to understand what success might be in a different world. John loved learning. The second love is that he loved Diane. So, you know, he was married to Diane for 48 years. And so I look to Van Gogh to help me explain that. Van Gogh says, "Love is eternal. And its aspect may change, but its essence will not." And that the same difference can often be said about the person who is not in love and who falls in love, as with an unlighted lamp and one that is burning. Because there was a good lamp. The good lamp was there. But until it was lit and is burning, did it fulfill its essential function? And I think that's what John found with Diane, is that it was through her that his essential function was performed in the love that he felt for her. So thank you, Diane, for sharing John with us and for lighting up his soul that shed his light on us. So thank you very much.
So, my name is Dan Bergstrom Noel. I have to explain that oftentimes. my born name was Daniel Noel, and then I met Nikki Bergstrom. And I became Dan Bergstrom Noel because we decided to take each other's names. And at first, that was hard for me. That was a hard thing to give up part of my name, and for Nikki, it was the same. And as I became part of this family, I realized how proud I am to have that name. So, that's not what I wanted to say. John would have been so happy to see all of us together. But what I think would have made him even happier would be as if we all got to know each other better. And there was nothing more telling than when we would come to visit for Thanksgiving or come visit for Christmas, and many people would come over to the house, and he would be so happy to bring people together and to introduce people. And one of the things that John taught me was the John Bergstrom handshake. And I hope that you know this handshake. Maybe you recognized it. I don't know. I found it endearing, special, amazing, and completely unique. And so I want to show you it in case you have forgotten. And I want you to do this handshake in his honor and his memory today. And I want you to introduce yourself to somebody that you don't know, that you have a connection to through John. And I want you to try this handshake. And this is how it is. And I don't know if you know this. I'm sure he shook your hand. Maybe you didn't realize it. But this is how I learned to shake John's hand. Here's the model. So when John would see me or anybody that he knew, he would always come underneath. And I think that is so telling of who he was. That it wasn't about the firmness of the handshake and the strength of the handshake, but it was about the connection with the person and about his connection with you. And he would always take his hand on top of your hand afterwards. It's in an embrace. And I find that to be so telling about who he was as a human being, who he was as a father-in-law, and who I want to be as a father. So I really encourage you to try that handshake today. In his memory, in his honor, and to try to reach out to touch somebody else's lives in the way that he has touched all of our lives.
Thank you. rather than walk up there, because it takes me more time to walk up and back than what I have to say, listening to you talk about John's handshake, that was the first thing that impressed me with John. The other part of the handshake, and it's a very important part, is the eye contact. He'd look you dead in the eyes, and the first time I met John, I thought, whoa, there's some depth there. I mean, he's deep. You look at him, you can see his intellect. And we had many discussions. He liked to talk about philosophy, and I would stand in the shallow end and listen to him. The most profound thing I ever heard John say, though, I heard him say it today, and we all heard him say it. He said, Bob, you know, having fun and not getting the grades, it isn't worth it. What a profound thing to say. And I think that really reflects his life, as I listened to everybody recount John, that he was about not just having fun, but doing the hard work as well. And I'm so pleased to have known John. Thank you.
I knew John not as long as most of you, but I too have been listening to all of the beautiful stories today, and I didn't know him as well as you, but I saw that in everything that he did. He was a very loving man. I just wanted to share, thank you for all of the beautiful stories. Two things came to me about John, and one of them was the morning after I heard that he had passed. And I was thinking, somebody has to say something. Somebody has to write something. And what came to me in the kitchen was, dear friend. And now I've heard that repeatedly today. What a dear friend he is, and he has been. The other thing I wanted to tell you was that this morning, a song came to me. I'm not going to sing it to you, but again, it is fitting for the John that we know. And the title of the song, I believe, is called True Love. I hope that you will recall the lyrics to that song of True Love, because I don't want to sing it to you. But at any rate, it's something like, I give to you, and you give to me. True Love. And I can't recall the other lyrics right now, but I was singing it all morning. So again, dear friend and true love, thank you so much.
I'm not going to get up. I met John through Diane, and the first thing I noticed was his eyes, because they actually looked at you and into you, and you could see what was going on behind them. But I wanted to tell Diane that she had it wrong, and I think, Bob, you had it wrong too. You were reading Chaucer to him. He was listening, and I'm glad to tell you, he is the very perfect gentle knight.
My name is Olga Bergstrom, and I am, I was going to say Uncle John's niece, but I guess I'm not saying it. And he, one of the things he did with us a lot was give us mix CDs and lots of music. So I think this song is something he wants to tell all of us. So he would give us this song.
When you're weary,
here on the street. When evening falls so hard, I will comfort you. I'll take your part.
There's a slideshow happening kind of around the corner in here where we can hang out and talk and handshake. And that's there. All right, thank you. The Turcos, thank you for picking up the program. There's so many people that have done so much this week. Honestly, this last week being here, it went from the rush of trying to get a car to get down to Tehachapi to get here as quickly as possible, to the down of seeing your father die, to the incredible joy of meeting all of you. And I get emails from people around the world with condolences. Every day I have like 10 emails in my inbox from people I've never met telling me how great John was. It's hard to be sad when you're surrounded by so much love. So personally, thank you to all of you. It's hard to know what, so we did the clapping thing at the beginning. What should we do at the end? Seems like we should clap in some form or another. This might be sacrilege, but in Japan there's this great thing called Sanbonjime. This is like my favorite way. Now to be honest, this is how you end a party. So this is a lot more celebratory. Maybe I think if you told someone in your panel, yeah, we ended our memorial service with someone, you know, this might be sacrilege, but I think it's well fitting for how this week has been. It's been a week of, to be honest, a lot of fun. I've loved hanging out with my mom. It's like fun minus one, really. And I think it's probably going to be fun minus one, especially for my mom and Nemo for a little while. But I think we've all expressed how John, my dad, was a big part of that fun side of who we are. So here's the way that Sanbon Jime works. I'm going to teach you this, and this is going to be the last thing we do. So if there's anything else that needs to get said, if I'm forgetting something, now's the time. After we hang out here and we eat a little bit and we handshake, we're going to head over to my mom's place for the reception. If you need directions, come let me know and I'll tell you how to get there. Is there anything I'm forgetting? Are we good? Okay, so here's how Sanbon Jime works.
We clap like this.
Hey!
So clap, 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 clap. Hey! We do that whole thing three times. And the hey gets louder every time. Now at the end in Japan, usually we say, arigato gozaimashita, and it's a thank you. I say at the end, you say whatever you damn well please. Are you ready? Thank you all for being here. Yo!